When you're at a dinner party and you tell people that you're a therapist, how do they respond?
I think people have uncomfortable reactions sometimes. You know, they'll say things like, oh, you're a therapist. Should I tell you about my childhood? you know, are you going to analyze me right now? Which I always think is really funny, because if I said that I were a gynecologist, they wouldn't say, are you going to give me a pelvic exam right now? But I think people think that because you're a therapist, you somehow have X-ray vision into their soul, which of course we do not.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Lori Gottlieb about her book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Thanks to NPR West for helping record this interview. Part of the book includes your foray into therapy as a patient yourself. And so what does it mean for a therapist to go into therapy?
Most therapists do go to therapy, not necessarily continuously, but certainly most therapists have spent time on the other side. I think that a lot of times our patients don't think about that very much. I think there's this idea that your therapist should have it all together and, you know, and not go through the vicissitudes of life in the same way that they are. But most of us do go to therapy or have gone to therapy.
Right. And in response to the question, how do we change? You answer that with in relation to others. But can you just describe what's the magic of therapy? What makes it work?
Therapy is a very rich human experience, and it's a relationship. And I think sometimes it's really hard to be with somebody else where there are no distractions. It's just you and the other person face to face, no phones, no screens. And you tell the truth of who you are in a way that we can be ashamed of outside of the therapy room. And I think what happens in that room is that you reveal yourself, and in revealing yourself, the therapist can hold up a mirror to you and help you to see your reflection in a way that you aren't yet aware of. So we can point out your blind spots and the way you keep shooting yourself in the foot over and over and ending up in the same place. People out in the world don't necessarily do that for you.
Lori, I watched a bit of your interview on Good Morning America, and you have an analogy about therapy and pornography. Can you replay that for our listeners?
I write in the book that therapy is a little bit like pornography because both have millions of users. Most people don't admit to using either. And there's a lot of secrecy around it. And also there's, you know, I think for some people there's a thrill to both of them that, you know, kind of like a guilty thrill.
I want to follow the thread of the guilty thrill into one of your patient cases. You start the book actually by introducing a rather challenging patient who you call John, and he's like this classic Hollywood bully walking around calling everybody idiots. And I just wanted to know, Lori, why start there?
I started there because John, at the very beginning, is hard to like. he's very abrasive. He's very insulting. He's somebody that, you know, you'd think you're not going to like this person. And I wanted people to go through the experience that I went through with him, which is that once I got to know why he was acting the way he was acting, because our behaviors are a way of protecting ourselves from something that is unspeakable or, you know, a way of coping with unmanageable pain. And I wanted to get into what was that? Why was he acting like this? And once we get to know him, you know, I came to feel deep affection for him and mm-hmm. really genuinely liked him. And you would never know that from the way he was introduced in the beginning and the way that's the way I met him in therapy. And I think that for the people who have read the book, he's one of the people that they tend to embrace the most. They tend to really just want to give him a big hug. And it's so unexpected. And I think I wanted to start with him because the way people present sometimes isn't necessarily what they're all about. And I think we need to understand more about what people are all about and give them that chance.
You did such a remarkable job of showing that transformation and bringing the reader in. I was just so curious, Lori, how do you straddle the worlds between being a therapist and a writer and between making, you know, what we might call a character lovable, but also doing that in real life in your office?
I was a writer before I became a therapist, and a lot of people think that they're completely different types of careers, but I think they're really about the same thing. As a journalist, I go in and I tell people's stories. And as a therapist, I go in and I help people to change their stories. And I'm working with story and the human condition. So when people come into me, I'm almost like an editor sitting in the therapist chair where somebody comes in with a story and it's usually a faulty narrative. It's like a first draft that needs revision. You know, they've got some story that they've been carrying around, like I'm unlovable or nothing will ever work out for me. Or in the case of John, the person we were just talking about, his story was I'm better than everybody else. Everybody else is an idiot. And those stories don't serve them. And they don't even realize that they're walking around with that story. And so I want to know, you know, in your story, who are the villains and who are the heroes? And maybe do they need some rejiggering? And is the protagonist moving forward or is the protagonist going in circles? You know, what are some of these plot points that maybe need some, you know, need to be revised? How can you control the plot going forward? So we're really looking at, you know, what is this narrative that you carry around? What is this voice in your head that guides your choices and decisions so that you can make better choices and decisions and change your story going forward?
And there's one point in John's work with you when he walks in and says, "Congratulations, you're not my mistress anymore." And I wanted to know, what does he mean by that?
So when I first meet him, he hands me a wad of cash at the end of the session. And he says, he doesn't want his wife to know that he's coming to therapy. So he says, "You'll be just like my mistress," as he hands me the cash. And then he says, "Actually, no, more like my hooker. You're not the kind of woman I'd choose as a mistress." And later on, when he says, "You're not my mistress anymore," what he means is, "I told my wife that I'm coming to therapy. This is not a secret anymore."
And what does it mean for us to admit that we are in therapy, you think, in a broader kind of cultural or relational way?
One of the reasons I wrote the book is that I wanted to demystify what therapy is. I think there are so many misconceptions around what this actually is when you go. So many people think that either you have to be, you know, in crisis, in deep crisis to go, or something's wrong with you if you go. You know, I think a lot of people think that it's kind of like with our physical health. If something feels off, you know, we're going to go get it checked out before, say, we have a massive heart attack, right?
Right.
But if something feels off emotionally, often we think, well, I have a roof over my head and food on the table, so, you know, my pain really isn't that. I don't really need to pay attention to it. It's not that important. We minimize it. And then what happens is if you kind of try to push down your feelings, they get stronger mm-hmm. and they come out in other ways. Maybe it's insomnia. Maybe it's depression. Maybe it's anxiety. Maybe it's a short-temperedness. Maybe it's a way of self-sabotaging yourself. But they'll make themselves be felt and seen. And what happens is often people come to therapy when they're having the equivalent of an emotional heart attack. You know, now they can't ignore it anymore. But why should they suffer unnecessarily for all that time? And also it's harder to treat when you come in the throes of crisis as opposed to almost like preventative medicine. Here's something that's going on. I want to try to work this out before it gets really bad.
Do you have any thoughts or reactions to modern portrayals of therapists on TV or in movies?
Well, I do because the book is being made into a television show.
Congratulations.
Thank you, with Eva Longoria producing it. So, and one of the things that's really important to me is that it doesn't portray a therapist in the way that I think media has, which is, you know, sort of one of two tropes. One is the brick wall, you know, the person who doesn't talk at all. But nobody wants to go to a robot, and I don't think most therapists are like that. And the other trope is the train wreck, the hot mess, the therapist who is very competent professionally but is falling apart in his or her personal life. Or they're crossing all of these boundaries, right, like in treatment, right? Where,
right,
you know, they're doing all these things that are completely inappropriate with their patients. That's just not reality.
Right.
And so, you know, what I wanted to do with the show is what I did with the book is I wanted to show a person who happens to be a therapist. So instead of a show about a therapist, it's this woman and here's her life and here's her family. And when she goes to work, yes, she's a therapist and she sees patients and we meet the patients and we see their lives and their families and them outside of the therapy room. And it's really just about the human condition through the lens of a woman whose job happens to be a therapist, if that makes sense, the mm-hmm. distinction that I'm making.
Part of the area that you cover in the book related to your personal life is about being a writer and being stalled out in your own writing process, including canceling another book contract. And I just wanted to know, looking back as a writer, how do you understand your relationship with creativity and productivity? You know, when do you feel compelled to produce and when do you call it off?
So in my case, it was directly related to the reason that I was in therapy, although I didn't know it when I got to therapy. So I got to therapy because my boyfriend and I were planning to get married, and then he announced that he had decided he didn't want to live with a kid under his roof for the next 10 years, and that kid at the time was my 8-year-old. Who had not, by the way, been hiding in the closet the entire time we were dating. So my version of the story was, you know, clearly, this guy's missing a few marbles because how could he not? Why did he start dating me in the first place when my son was 6? You know, if you didn't want to be a parent again, his kids were about to go to college. And so I get into therapy, and one of the first things that happens is I say, you know, I've wasted all this time with this guy, and now I'm in my 40s, and half my life is over. And my therapist gloms onto that statement, half my life is over. Mm. And that becomes what the therapy is about, which is this question of how am I spending my time, given that I'm very aware now of my own mortality. I'm very aware that I don't have forever and I can't waste the time that I do have here on the planet. And one of the ways that I was wasting my time, even though I didn't admit this to my therapist for quite some time, was that I was supposed to be writing a book about happiness. And it was, and the book was making me miserable. The happiness book, I called it the stupid, miserable, depression-inducing happiness book. Because I was starting out as a therapist at the time, and I felt like I could write a book about happiness and I could cite interesting studies, but really it didn't capture the richness and the beauty and the joy and the pain of what I was seeing in the therapy room,
yeah,
and what real life is about. And I really wanted to capture that, and I felt like I couldn't do it in this book, but my agent at the time said, well, you have to write this book, because I'd already turned down a book about parenting that based on an Atlantic piece that I had written, that I was offered this, you know, ridiculous amount of money for, and I said no, stupidly. And then I said, I want to write about the adults. And so they said, well, write a happiness book. And I thought, okay, well, I'll make it my own book. But as I sat down to write it, I couldn't do it. I was paralyzed. And it was because it didn't feel authentic to me. It felt like I was wasting my time and it wouldn't do a service to readers. One thing I really wanted to do was write something meaningful that would resonate with people, that people would feel like that touched me, that moved me, that changed my life in some small way. And so I was paralyzed, and I was told I would never write another book if I canceled this because I already said no to the parenting book, and then there was this happiness book. And I'd never been in that situation creatively before. And so the thought was, well, just write this book and then you can write what you want after. But I physically could not write this book. And I was so ashamed of the fact that I couldn't write it. And I was under contract and I had to write it because I was paying for my internship with the book advance. So, and I'm a single parent. So it was all tied up in this necessity as well. But I couldn't tell anybody that I wasn't writing it. I felt so much shame. And so I was kind of like the closet gambler who gets dressed for work every day and then kisses her family goodbye and then goes to the casino instead of the office. I would just be on Facebook, or I would be writing these fabulously witty emails to my boyfriend and pretending that I was writing, and I couldn't tell anybody that I wasn't.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Lori Gottlieb about her book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. I want to know more about the process of how this book came from the ashes of that.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. They were definitely ashes. I canceled the book. And, you know, it was because of something that my therapist said, by the way, which was at one point I was talking about feeling trapped by all these external circumstances. And he said, "You remind me of this cartoon." And it's of a prisoner shaking the bars, desperately trying to get out. But on the right and the left, the bars are open. Mm-hmm. And he said, "You know, I don't think you want to see that the bars are open." And it's true, because I think so many of us would rather be shaking those bars saying, "Oh, you know, all these things are trapping me in my life," being the victim, as opposed to saying, "Yeah, I can walk around those bars, but with freedom comes responsibility, and now I'm going to have to be responsible for certain things." And I think that's scary for people to walk into, A, uncertainty. We don't do well with uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You know, if I cancel the book, what does that mean? Right. What will I do? But I did eventually cancel the book, and it was like a weight had been lifted off of me. Even though I didn't think I would write another book, I didn't have an idea for another book, but I knew I could not write something that felt fraudulent to me. And then months later, after a therapy session, I just started writing about what was going on. And I started writing this book about my relationship with my patients. And I didn't think it was going to be a book. It felt so good to be able to write again. And then later I decided, hey, maybe this is the book that I wanted to write, which was I wanted to just bring people into the therapy room, show them what I see so that they can see aspects of themselves in these patients. But I also felt like I had to bring myself into it as the fifth patient, because I was going through this upheaval in my own life, and to leave out that whole part of the story felt so disingenuous. It felt like I'm the expert up on high. And what is that really going to show people if they can't see my humanity too?
It made me wonder, what was the most vulnerable part of writing the book? Because you write about beginning as a therapist, you write about your personal life and your health, and then also just the vulnerability of writing yourself as a clinician.
What was great about the way the book went down, meaning it came from the ashes, as you said, is that this book, I thought, was not going to be widely read. I felt like I needed to write it because if it helped somebody, great. And I thought it was the right book and the true book and the authentic book and the one that I wanted to write, that I needed to write. And so I felt very free to be vulnerable in that first draft, because mm-hmm. I thought, you know, two people are going to read this book, but I hope it helps them. I didn't realize that it was going to be read so widely. So I think if I had known that, it's almost like childbirth, where like if I knew it was going to be that much pain, I might have, you know, not gone through with it, even though now I'm glad I did. The same thing with the book, that, you know, I would have been paralyzed, I think, on the page about how am I coming off. But I just let it rip on the page. And I don't hold back, and I don't always come off in a way that, you know, I would like to come off. But that's reality. That's what I was going through at the time.
Lori, as a therapist myself, I often joke that part of the decadence in this day and era seems to be that it's 1 hour in which two people agree not to use email. And the way that you write it is the therapy room seemed to be one of the only places left where two people sit in a room together for an uninterrupted 50 minutes. So can you talk a little bit about what you think it means to be a therapist today, and what are some of the themes that you're seeing in the room?
One of the themes I'm seeing relates to what you just said, which is when I was training, we interns were rushing all the time. In this many years, I will be done with my hours. In this many years, I will take my boards. And in this many years, I will be licensed. And she said at one point that we were missing the point. We were missing the present and what we were doing there. And at one point she quipped, the speed of light is outdated. Now everybody moves at the speed of want. And I, you know, and we all sort of sat there stunned. You know, she said, like, you won't get today back. And yet we didn't have time to think about it.
Right.
But I do see that people will, you know, really want a quick fix to whatever's going on. How many sessions will this take? Can you help me make this decision? You know, those kinds of things. As opposed to doing the work, doing the heavy lifting of going inside of oneself and really understanding what's going on a deeper level.
The second paragraph to that section that I read really struck me, and this is what you say. The second people felt alone, I noticed, usually in the space between things, leaving a therapy session at a red light, standing in a checkout line, riding an elevator, they picked up their devices and ran away from the feeling. In a state of perpetual distraction, they seemed to be losing the ability to be with others and the ability to be with themselves.
I see that so much, where no matter what people are coming in with, often there's an underlying sense of loneliness, even if they're surrounded by people in their lives. They can be surrounded by family and friends and coworkers, but people aren't connecting in the same way. You know, they're liking their friends' things on Facebook or Instagram, but they're not really having that I-thou, you know, interaction that we call it in the therapy room, which is I'm sitting across from you, I'm really listening, I'm not distracted, nothing's pinging or dinging or vibrating.
Yeah, right.
And I think we can't, we've lost the sense of being able to tolerate our own feelings because we can't really sit with them because there's always a distraction. A colleague of mine calls the internet the most effective short-term non-prescription painkiller out there.
Wow.
And I think it's true that, you know, we see people, you get in an elevator and everybody's on their phones because they can't tolerate either the proximity to other people without, you know, just being close to them and nobody's talking and that feels awkward. And people used to do that all the time before cell phones, right? You'd get in an elevator and you'd ride with strangers and that would be, you know, that was something that you did. Also, people will leave the therapy room, like our session is up, and before they even get to the door, they whip out their phones, right? And it makes me think that, you know, it's so sad because you want people to reflect on, just take a minute to kind of transition back out to wherever you're going next and maybe sit with whatever just happened in the room. But it just, boom, it goes away because they're on their phones already.
There's a point in the book where you're with your own hairdresser and he's talking about getting on Tinder therapy. And I was just thinking of, you know, what are the other ways that we move towards relationship, whether it's through technology or not?
I think that connection is the glue. Connection is what everybody wants. Everyone wants to love and be loved. And so many people have trouble doing that. The person who cuts my hair was saying, oh, you know, I could never be a therapist listening to people's problems all day. But that's not what therapy is. You know, if someone's just coming in and complaining every week, they're not doing the work. I always say that in therapy, you need to be both vulnerable and accountable. We say that insight is the booby prize of therapy, that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't make changes between sessions out in the world, the insight is useless. And he was saying, the person who cuts my hair was saying, you know, I just wouldn't want to listen to people all day.
Right.
You know, and I said, have you ever been to therapy? And he's like, ah, heck no. and I said, well, what do you do, you know, when you get like sad or lonely or, you know, and he said, oh, Tinder. and I said, and then what happens? You hook up with people? And he said, yeah. And then I said, well, you know, doesn't that feel empty after a while? And then he just, you know, he goes back on Tinder. And it's, you know, I think he's not unusual.
Right.
I think that a lot of people are trying to connect, but people don't take the time to get to know one another. People are moving so quickly. I had somebody come for therapy where she was telling me that she was doing the apps, the dating apps. She was in her 20s and she really wanted a partner. And she had gone on a date with someone. And then she went on a date the day before she came to therapy. She said, I didn't even realize until I got there that we had already been on a date.
Yeah, right.
That you know, you're just cycling through right. people so quickly that you don't even pay attention to who you're meeting.
I want to ask two questions as we wind down, Lori. One would be, then in addition to the richness of experience in therapy, what do you imagine for ways that we can continue to be more present in connecting with others?
I think one of the reasons that people feel so disconnected is that they have a hard time tolerating their feelings. You know, they think that if they feel momentary sadness or anxiety or grief, you know, a lot of people will say, like, this happened 5 years ago. Why am I still grieving? Well, because grief is like that. So I don't say that glibly. I mean, it's you know, if of course you're going to have pain around a significant loss, and it's not just going to disappear. You will still, it will live with you throughout your life in different ways at different times. You know, if you didn't love somebody that deeply, you wouldn't be feeling that. So the good news is that you were able to love that deeply, and you hopefully will be able to love that deeply again. But I think people have trouble sitting with those feelings. And so I would say that, you know, I always say to people, feelings are like the weather. They're like weather systems. They blow in, they blow out. Don't be so afraid of a storm. Don't be so afraid of some cloudy weather, because it will blow in just like the sunny weather will blow in, and that will blow out too. So be able to, you know, sit with your feelings and know that that's part of the entirety of your experience. It's what makes you human.
And my last question is, what do you tell, you know, friends or family members or acquaintances who are wanting to get into therapy but don't know how or where to begin?
I think it's such a sign of strength to make that call and come in. You know, I always, whenever people come in, I'm interested in not just why are they here, but why now? Why this week did you make that call when this might have been going on for a while? I want to know about their readiness and the strength that made them make that call. And so I think that, you know, you can find therapists through your insurance plan. You can find them through Psychology Today. You can do the dreaded Google search, but I do think you can, you know, you get a sense of someone maybe from what you find, what they write on their website. You can ask a friend for a referral. A great way to find a therapist is to, if your friend likes his or her therapist, ask that person to ask their therapist for a referral for you. You'll probably get a really good referral. I refer for my patients, if they have friends who want to go to therapy but don't necessarily want to see the same therapist, I will absolutely give them a good referral. And then go in for a consultation and just see how you feel in that consultation. Make sure that you feel good. If you leave and you ask yourself, did I feel understood and was this person easy to talk to, I'd go back for a second session. If you didn't, maybe go for another consultation with somebody else.
Lori Gottlieb is a psychotherapist, New York Times bestselling author, and weekly Dear Therapist columnist for The Atlantic. She lives in California. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.